Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Anwa Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Anwa Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Well, hello. Welcome to another edition of NucleCast, the Legacy Series. We've got a very special guest today. I am your guest host, Jim Howe, filling in for Adam. We've got with us General Robin Rand, who is a recently retired Air Force general, has an amazing career, and currently has a very amazing position as well. So we want to kind of start off this two-part series by talking mostly about the general's background, where he came from, and kind of how he got to the head of Global Strike Command for the Air Force. It's a pretty fascinating story. So, General, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to have you here. So talk to us a little bit. How did you come to join the Air Force? Where were you raised? What was the Air Force all about for you?
Sure. Well, my dad was an airman in the Air Force, served in World War II, Korea, Vietnam. And he retired about the time I graduated from high school. So I'm sure that had a big influence on me, candidly. I lived all over the world, to be honest with you, but settled in high school in Colorado Springs, was a football and baseball player, and the academy reached out to me to come and play intercollegiate athletics. And I wasn't quite up to task academically, so I went to the United States Air Force Academy Prep School in 1974. And then after that year, I was offered an appointment, and I entered the academy in the summer of 1975. And that was the beginning of what turned out to be a 40-year journey in the Air Force.
So I just got to ask, when you swore in that day, it's probably a pretty terrifying day with everyone yelling at you and making you do push-ups and run around. Did you see yourself retiring as a four-star general?
Oh, no. No way. Just getting through the academy and getting commissioned and kind of one step at a time. So never, ever imagined being a general officer. So until it happened. So. And that's very true. I mean, not fibbing on that one at all. I often tell people I'm four stars more than I deserve, and certainly four stars more than I ever expected.
Understood. Got it. So you have a fascinating career, F-16 pilot, but you first, you know, went to flight school, and when you got out of flight school, they kept you on as an instructor pilot, which is a pretty huge honor. How did that time as an instructor pilot shape your thinking and your perspective about the Air Force and about flying in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. I went through pilot training and it was not the easiest thing I've ever done by any stretch of the imagination, and was really honored and grateful to earn my wings. And the Air Force decided at that time that I was going to stay on. We call it first assignment instructor pilots. So I was a young second lieutenant, left Williams Air Force Base, which is now closed, but it was a great base on the east side of Phoenix. And we graduated from there, went down to San Antonio for training as an instructor pilot in the T-37, and then went back to Williams and stayed there. It was great, you know. At the time, flew 2-3 times a day. This was the Reagan era. We were really trying to build up the Air Force and the number of flying wings. And so the class size grew. We had a big classes. And we were busy. So for a young lieutenant, very junior captain, you know, the job was to show up and teach and fly. And it was great. You know, it was great. It wasn't something that I knew I was going to be doing for the remainder of my career, but at the time, it was certainly wonderful. Got a lot of experience and, you know, the human element of interacting with people just a little bit older, or actually younger, excuse me, than me. I mean, we were contemporaries. As I said, I was still a second lieutenant when I finished training at Randolph and showed up for the first 6 months as a second lieutenant teaching other second lieutenants. So that's kind of funny, isn't it? But we still do that today. I mean, in Air Education Training Command, many of the instructors are again called first assignment instructor pilots. So what we lacked in experience, world Air Force experience, I think hopefully we make up for with our desire and attitude and the decent hands and ability to teach and fly. So it was great. I loved it.
Fantastic. So one thing that struck me when I look at your subsequent tours of duty, flying the F-16, you went all over the world. You're in Spain, South Korea, right. Japan, Germany, here in the States. First, is that typical for an Air Force F-16 pilot? And second, what are the kind of the things that you remember about those days?
Sure. Back up a little bit. So in the late 70s, early 80s is a great time. A lot of modernization had gone on. We had brought on the relatively new A-10, the F-15, and the F-16 were three new fighters. And so timing was good for me. And I was able to, after I finished my 3.5 years of teaching at Willie, I was able to get an F-16. And that was just, you know, a dream come true. I knew I wanted to go have an opportunity to fly fighters, and to get the F-16 at that time was exceptional. And the F-16 had replaced a lot of F-4 that were around our Air Force. And so we were really all over the world, and we had F-16s in multiple places in the United States. We had them in multiple places in Europe, and we were expanding where F-16s were in the Pacific area of operations and responsibility. So it wasn't uncommon at all to expect to do overseas assignments. And so I went to MacDill Air Force Base at Tampa for F-16 training. And back then you put your dream sheet down, and a lot of people wanted to go to Germany. And we put down Torrejon Air Base, Spain, right outside of Madrid, and was selected to go there. And so my first operational assignment was overseas to Spain, which was a fascinating place to be at that time. This was still during the Cold War, and F-16s sat nuclear alert, believe it or not. And we didn't sit nuclear alert in Spain. We actually would go to, at that time, Aviano Air Base in Italy and Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. And that's where we sat our nuclear alert from Torrejon. And that was a fascinating experience. But those were great days, great flying. Going to Turkey and in Italy and flying there was really special and incredible. So it wasn't unusual to be overseas.
Did you have a favorite amongst those various overseas postings?
Well, so I'm at Torrejon, not late to fighters, but I had spent my first, as I said, first few years flying in the T-37, and I get to Torrejon, and it was fascinating, and it was neat, you know, the whole Cold War era and what we were trying to do still. And I got tapped on the shoulder, and they said, hey, guess what? You're going to go be an air liaison officer with the Army. And I didn't see that one coming. I remember at the time going, you got to be kidding me. You know, I worked hard to get in the F-16, and I'd only been in it a little over 2 years at the time where I got tapped on the shoulder. And I said, well, where's that at? And they said, Bamberg, Germany, which was near the border of the Czech Republic. And at the time, we had two corps in Germany, the 5th Corps, which was responsible, if you will, for the Fulda Gap, and 7th Corps, which was more for the southern part of Germany. And our area of responsibility was along the Czech border. So the good news is we got to live in Germany. The bad news is I got yanked out of the F-16 fairly quickly after I got in it. But that all worked out fantastic. And it gave me an opportunity to really appreciate what our soldiers do, certainly what the land forces do, and appreciate you know, what was going on in Europe at that time. So, and also it gave me an opportunity to lead young airmen and soldiers. As I was by that time kind of a mid-level captain, and it was a great leadership opportunity. It turned out to be, you know, a remarkable assignment. What sticks out to me, Jim, is, you know, this was the height of the Cold War. I mean, you know, I went into Berlin, and it was East Berlin and West Berlin, and the wall was still up, and we had the right to travel into Berlin, because when World War II ended, you know, it was the United States, the Allies were United States, Britain, France, and Russia. And the way they divided up the country at the time, or the city of Berlin, what it ended up becoming was West Berlin was the French, the U.S., and the British sector, and East Berlin was the Russian sector. And we all remember back, if we know our history, 1961, when the wall, you know, instantly popped up. But those four countries had the right, the military, to go visit the other sectors. And so as a U.S. military member, we had the right to go into East Berlin. The Russians did not afford the East Berliners and the East Germans that same right to travel over into West Berlin. That's why they put up the wall. But that was fascinating. And I remember, if you hang with me, this was 1986 to 1988. And I remember thinking that I would never see the wall come down in my life. It just didn't seem like it was a possibility. And yet, less than 2 years later, I was now on an assignment in Japan, and with our one TV station we had on Far Eastern Network, turn on a fledgling network, I think called CNN, and they show, you know, people hammering the wall down. And that just is something I'll never forget, that I didn't think I'd ever see that, you know, in my lifetime. And you know, the rest is history, and we know how that has played out. It's certainly a very dynamic and dangerous world environment, but that was kind of what we termed the end of the Cold War. And I got to see it kind of firsthand when I was over in Europe right before I, you know, right after I left, the wall came down. So that was very memorable. So from the ALO job, the air liaison job with the Army, they saw fit to send me back to the F-16. So I went back to the United States, retrained, and our next assignment was to Japan, and that's Misawa Air Base, which is on the northeast border of the island of Honshu. And so three consecutive overseas assignments. I did Spain, Germany, then we went to Misawa, my wife, and then fairly young children, and it was just fascinating. And again, you know, our threat and our focus was pretty much on exclusively on Russia, this, you know, the Soviet Union. But being in Japan was a very interesting time, a lot of great flying. But while I was there was when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And, you know, now fast forward to August of 1990, and then the January of 1991, Desert Shield, Desert Storm. My unit did not get activated from Misawa. The war didn't last long enough, and we didn't get activated. So I sat that one out. But as we know, that began the Air Force's 30-year journey of spending time over in the Middle East, particularly a lot of time, you know, against Iraq and serving there. So.
And you'd have some experience that later in your career with both up close and personal, and also on the policy side. But you went to the Naval War College in 1997. Then you had a number of increasingly, impactful leadership roles.
Yeah. I mean, only let me just mention this, if I may, because it's kind of relevant. So I did 4 years over in Japan, which was fascinating. But the world was changing pretty rapidly. And, you know, the Middle East changed some things. But I came home, the Air Force reassigned me back to Nellis Air Force Base. And while I was in Misawa, Japan, I went to the United States Air Force at that time, fighter weapons school in the F-16, went back to Misawa, finished my tour there, and then was assigned back to Nellis as an instructor and the operations officer in the F-16 division of the weapons school. And that was a two-year assignment when, again, I got tapped on the shoulder for now, I guess, my fifth overseas assignment, if I do my math, or fourth. And we were reassigned to Osan Air Base, Korea. And that was a fascinating assignment. And I only mentioned that to you, Jim, because I told you I never thought the wall would come down, you know, that invisible wall in Europe, but it did. But when I showed up in Korea, as it still is today, you know, the 38th parallel and the North Korea and South Korea, and I spent 3 years there, and our sole focus was to, you know, make sure that the North would never come south again like they did in June of 1950. And tip of the spear and really mission focused, and, you know, one mission, and that was to defend the Republic of Korea. That's why we were there, and we still are there. But while we're there in Korea, all this other stuff is going on over in the Middle East, particularly Iraq. Now Desert Storm's over, but we're doing the no-fly zones in North Iraq and South Iraq, you know, Operation Southern Watch and Northern Watch. And that's all happening, and the Air Force is gainfully employed doing lots and lots of deployments to the Middle East. And I've now spent, you know, what was it, seven of 9 years in the Pacific. So before I came back, and that was where my focus was making sure. And it was testy, as it still is. You know, the North Koreans were always pushing the limits and always testing. And we really had a sense that we needed to be there. It was not taken lightly. When I finished that assignment in 1997, I'm now a lieutenant colonel. I've commanded a fighter squadron, the 36 Fabulous Flying Fiends at Osan. And I'm feeling pretty, you know, I'm thinking I'm kind of at the twilight of my career. I'm approaching the 18, 19 year mark now. And that's when I went to the Naval War College for a year.
Nothing like a year in beautiful Newport. But after that, you came out of there and had a number of, you know, impactful command tours, right, culminating as a brigadier general, newly promoted brigadier general. You went back to Iraq, the Expeditionary Air Wing?
Yeah, so you know, I come back from the United States to the United States to the Naval War College. We had spent now at this time about 11 or 12 years overseas with that 2 year break at Nellis from the Naval War College, which was a great year to be able to learn and spend time with soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, international partners, civilian, State Department folks. This is a great assignment. Kids were now in high school age. And following that, we got assigned to the Pentagon, and I worked in the Joint Staff. Couldn't wait to get out of there, and figured maybe I got selected to be a colonel, and I was hoping that I had one more command left in me. I didn't view myself as anything special other than I loved the Air Force and loved the mission and our people. And while I was finishing up my Pentagon tour, I got notified I was going to go to Luke Air Force Base, at the time home of the fighter pilot, lots and lots of F-16s there, 200 of them, as a matter of fact, and I was the deputy ops group commander. I pinned on colonel, and in April of 2001, do your math now, I get assigned back to Nellis Air Force Base as the United States Air Force Weapons School Commandant. And I'm there about 4 months into that tour when 9/11 happened. And that certainly had a trajectory on my career that, you know, that changed a lot of things. So 9/11 happens, and we are now locked and loaded and focused back into the Middle East, which we had never left. but now even more intensity with the invasion of as we went into Afghanistan and then Iraq. I finished up my tour at Nellis, and there's still this pesky adversary called North Korea, though. And I go back to Korea for my second assignment, and this time it's the commander of the 8th Fighter Wing, the Wolfpack, down at Kunsan Air Base, Korea. And everyone at Kunsan had one thing in common. We were all there on one-year assignments with our families, and again, solely focused on North Korea. So all this other stuff going on in the Middle East, you've got 25,000 airmen and soldiers and sailors and Marines stationed, mostly soldiers and mostly airmen stationed in Korea. And our focus, as it is still today, is to make sure they don't come south of the 38th parallel again. So that's when I'm at Korea as my first wing command. I get selected for Brigadier General, much to my surprise. And my follow-on assignment is to go back to Luke Air Force Base as the commander of the 56th Fighter Wing. We had at the time 8 F-16 squadrons, 206 F-16s there. It was the primary training for all F-16 folks was at Luke. And that was a marvelous assignment. And while we were training F-16 pilots and getting them ready, we were also sending a lot of our folks into Iraq and Afghanistan to support combat operations there. That was my second consecutive wing command. I remember my boss was General Bill Looney, the commander of Air Education Training Command, and he asked me on his visit what I wanted to do next, and I remember telling him, sir, I'd love to go get some sand in my boots. And he was able to work it with the Air Force for me to then go over to Balad Air Base, Iraq, with the 332nd Air Expeditionary Wing, which at that time was a one-star, as was Luke. They were both one-star wing commands positions. So in 2006 is when I went to Iraq and spent a little over 12 months there at a very difficult time. That was, by any metric, the war wasn't going so well for us. Sectarian violence was horrific. The Iraq was a difficult place. You know, you had the Sunnis and Shia in a civil war. You had the Kurds trying to figure out this thing called governance. There was just a lot of the Al-Qaeda was pretty much at full speed. So, but it's a tough, tough year. That year happened to be from 2006 to 2007, the most fatalities, the most casualties, the highest incidence of sectarian violence. And it was also in January of 2007 that President Bush elected that he was going to surge, and we brought an additional 30,000 men and women into Iraq. And we knew it'd be worse before it got better. So from January to 07 to July of 07, my last 6 months there, was a tough, tough time. But it did get better. The surge worked, and we actually did make a lot of headway. But I left before you started seeing some of the positive trends. So that had a lasting impression, you know, a mark on me, commanding men and women in combat when you're being shot at daily and losing men and women and experiencing, you know, a lot of the casualties and injuries was obviously a very sobering and impactful year for me personally.
Understood. We're going to take a real quick break and come back and finish out the rest of your career, especially your transition to Global Strike Command. Okay. So with that, we'll be right back.
Thanks, Jim.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back with NucleCast and General Robin Rand with a fascinating story of his career. Now, you're in Iraq. It is really quite fabulous if you think about it. It's pretty amazing what we do in the military these days, you know, traveling all over the world, you know, putting your life on the line every day. It's pretty impressive. But you came back and you were working in the Pentagon. You director for Middle East Policy and Office of the Secretary of Defense. You ended up in legislative liaison, running that office, very important, you know, working with the Congress of the U.S. How did those experiences kind of color your thinking when it came to the strategic deterrent and the importance of it?
Sure. Well, you know, leaving Iraq, where I was flying 2 to 3 combat missions a week and leading, you know, men and women in combat to the Pentagon, to the Office of Secretary of Defense was a big adjustment, let there be no doubt. But it was a fascinating time because, you know, we were really trying to figure out how we could have a positive, you know, drawdown in Iraq. Afghanistan wasn't quite the focus nearly as much as Iraq was at that time. And getting a bird's eye view of how the civilian sector of the military, OSD, works compared to how the joint staff and certainly the military members works was interesting. And it was also interesting because I was there my first year in OSD under the Republican President Bush administration, and then was there the second year when they transitioned. And it doesn't matter, I'm nonpartisan, but to be there when there's an administration change in OSD is a fascinating experience because a lot of the senior leadership and the Office of Secretary of Defense are political appointees. And so one day there were all these people leading OSD, and when the inauguration happened, they're all gone. And it took about 6 to 7 months to fill out a lot of those senior political appointee positions. And that was a fascinating experience to see that and experience that. So I learned a lot. I appreciated the opportunity to see how that part of our government works, and it was a real honor and privilege. I then went, as you said, got selected for my second star and became the Air Force Legislative Liaison. And my bosses were the Chief of Staff of the Air Force and the Secretary of the Air Force. And that, again, was fascinating. I couldn't spell Legislative Liaison before I showed up. But I would tell people it was like being in ninth grade civics again, to watch how one of the branches of government works. We have the executive branch, we have the judicial branch, and we have the legislative branch. And to see how the authorizers and the appropriators work and to be part of that and to have a 50-yard line seat, whenever the chief or secretary would go over to the Hill, to Congress, I would accompany them, be their note taker. We worked extensively with the congressional members' staffs, and it really was eye-watering to see that. It really was fascinating. So gave me an appreciation for our government, you know, the good and the bad, no doubt.
We have plenty of both, that's right.
I was able to, I keep getting surprised. The Air Force selected me, and our leadership selected me for my third star, and I got to do something I had very little experience with. In fact, none. I had quite a bit of experience in Europe, as we talked about early in my career. I was very fluent in what was going on in the Pacific region because of my tours in Japan and in Korea. But I got a third star, and I was sent to Tucson, Arizona, as the commander of 12th Air Force, and Air Force Southern Command, which was a component to U.S. Southern Command, which is responsible for the Caribbean, Central America, and South America. And I had two hats. I was an organized training equipped for 10 operational wings in Air Combat Command, and that was great. I got requalified in the F-16 and was flying again. But I also was the component to the Southern Command, and spent a lot of time with our partners in Central and South America. Again, totally new to me, But these are our friends in our own backyard. And that was an eye-opening experience. And if you remember, by this time, we're now talking 2012, our focus has been where? For the last 20 years, our focus had been on what's going on in the Middle East. And much to this regret, we had taken our eye off the ball, in my humble opinion, on our neighbors who are mostly our friends in Central and South America. And that was very interesting, trying to do what we could to help those struggling governance and countries with their security and their governance. But wow, it was a fascinating job. So I'm at this point in time absolutely convinced that would be my last assignment in the Air Force. I'd been in by then over 32 years. And I got a tap on the shoulder, a phone call from our chief of staff, General Mark Welsh, an amazing leader and dear friend. And he asked me and selected me to go be the commander of Air Education and Training Command at San Antonio, Randolph Air Force Base. I got my fourth star out of that job. I started in Air Education Training Command as a second lieutenant when I went to pilot training. And I went there going, well, this is where I'm going to finish. I'll finish my career at Air Education Training Command. It was fascinating. We did all the training, the recruiting, the education. Every airman starts in AETC. We all had that in common. We all undergraduate flying. We had the recruiting. We did the technical training. We did the education out of Air University. It was a phenomenal job. I loved every second of it. And I knew I was going to retire out of that. And that's when, again, I got tapped on the shoulder by General Welsh again and finished up moving to Barksdale's Air Force Global Strike Commander.
So talk to us. As a fighter pilot, now you're in charge of Air Force missiles and bombers. How was that transition? How did you approach it?
I'll give you the real short version. When the Air Force in 1947 became an independent service, shortly after that stood up Strategic Air Command, SAC. And its purpose was to be responsible for long-range strike and the strategic deterrence. SAC was a very powerful command. Second commander was Curtis LeMay. He was there for almost 8 years. SAC was a big command. It was responsible for the intercontinental ballistic missiles, the bombers, the tankers, and it was the force to be reckoned with during the Cold War. But for reasons that I feel turned out to be short-sighted and probably regret as we look back, after the Cold War ended, the Air Force downsized and it made a decision to consolidate and reorganize. And one of the decisions was to eliminate Strategic Air Command. And they moved the forces, the bombers, into TAC, which then turned into Air Combat Command. They moved the missiles from SAC into initially Air Combat Command, but then Air Force Space Command. And then they moved the tankers to Air Mobility Command. And so they bifurcated SAC and spread the forces out. Well, then that decision was in 1991. And we know it happened. And from 1991 to 2007, 8, our focus is what's the Middle East. That's where our focus is. And we were not really focusing on that other parts of the world. Well, the wheels came off. And we took our eye off the ball. Not willfully, but we did. And there wasn't a single keeper, and we had some serious incidents that occurred with our nuclear enterprise that blackened our eyes and didn't look good. And so in 2009, a decision was made that we needed to reestablish a command that was going to be focused on the nuclear enterprise in the Air Force. That was going to be on the bomber and the intercontinental ballistic leg, two legs of the triad. That happened in 2009, but when they stood up, the command stood up as SAC again for 1 hour, and then it was renamed, And I think partly because there was U.S. Strategic Command, they didn't want to confuse it. It was renamed Air Force Global Strike Command, and it stood up as a three-star, and that stayed that way until I showed up 6 years later after the command stood up, and I was the first four-star commander of Air Force Global Strike because the decision was made to upgrade it. And again, that decision was partly born out of challenges that we still had in the nuclear enterprise. And we had some challenges in the missile fields that, again, really highlighted some of the deficiencies. So that's, I think, General Welch made the decision to move me there. I was not a missileer. I was not a bomber pilot. I had served, though, and had some experience in the nuclear enterprise from earlier in my career. But I showed up, parachuted in pretty much as kind of a stranger and unfamiliar with the real mission of what Air Force Global Strike did at the time.
Well, we're kind of running low on time, but let me just ask if there is one or two lessons that you took away from Global Strike Command that really kind of apply to what's happening today in the world.
Sure. First of all, the men and women that serve in Air Force Global Strike Command are spectacular. And I'm so honored that I could serve with them. And they really, I think, are so critical to national security. And they provide that umbrella. And they hold the wolves at bay. They absolutely do. They deter our adversaries every day. And they assure our allies. And they assure that there's not a proliferation of nuclear weapons in this world, because we provide that umbrella for our friends and our partners. And so it was a fascinating experience. And I know we'll wrap it up with time, but that was a really neat time, because a lot of decisions were made in that 2015 to 2018 timeframe when I commanded to modernize and upgrade the nuclear enterprise. And so I had a front row seat and my hands in that pie that whole 3 years. And that was just absolutely a fascinating time. One of the, hard to put into words how honored I was to finish my career as the commander of Air Force Global Strike Command.
And what a career it was. Well, General, I can't thank you enough for your time for this first Legacy Series interview. And we'll be following up with the second interview to talk about what you're up to today, which is equally fascinating. So thank you very much for your service to our nation, for all the great work you've done over 4 decades.
I'm sure your listeners are falling asleep by now, Jim, but I appreciate that.
I hope not. But again, thanks. It's great speaking to you about your storied career. So with that, we will sign off for this edition of NucleCast, and thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Jim.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Frunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it, and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.